This is ARRL's Eclectic Tech, a bi-weekly look at the technical and scientific side of amateur radio with your host Steve Ford, WB8IMY. Eclectic Tech is brought to you by ICOM. ICOM, for the love of ham radio, is about the passion for an incredible hobby. Visit ICOM in the community webpage at www.icomamerica.com/community.
I'm on the telephone with Carl Luchelswab, K9LA, and in case you're not familiar with the call sign, he is the ARRL Central Division Director, but he's also a scientist, a researcher who has spent basically his entire career researching propagation, solar activity, and so on. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, Steve. Hope you're doing well.
You too. Carl, as we approach the peak of the solar cycle, which is predicted to take place in 2025, 2026, I'm starting to see, particularly online, news stories popping up where reporters are looking for an angle, a scary angle, on calamities that may happen then. And in particular, they cite the Carrington event of 1859, and they're saying, uh-oh, two more years and or three more years, whatever it is, civilization itself could collapse. To start, what is the Carrington event, Carl?
Okay. That is a Carrington event is a very remarkable solar disturbance that affected the Earth back in 1859. Let's take a step back and talk about disturbances to propagation.
Certainly.
NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has categorized solar disturbances into three major categories. One is geomagnetic storms, and what that is coronal mass ejections or coronal holes, and what they do is disturb the Earth's magnetic field, which can screw up the ionosphere. The second one is solar radiation storms. That's when a big solar flare emits energetic protons, relativistic protons, very high energy, very fast. And those protons funnel into the polar cap being the area inside the auroral oval. They funnel into the polar cap and cause increased D-region absorption, which kind of screws up over the pole paths for us ham radio operators. The third is radio blackouts, which, again, it's a big solar flare. It can emit very large amounts of X-ray radiation, which ionizes the D region on the daylight side of Earth. And as the name implies, radio blackouts, stations go away. So what happened back in 1859 was a big solar flare and a CME, a coronal mass ejection. It so happened that Richard Carrington was kind of observing the sun with his colleague, Richard Hodgson, and they saw a very bright flash on September 1st, 1859. The flash was probably one of the brightest in history, and further efforts by scientists nowadays have determined that probably the flare magnitude was much greater than X10. Now, solar flares are measured in A, B, C, M, and X logarithmic classes, with A being the smallest, X being the biggest. And our scales only go to X10. So the Carrington event would have saturated the measurements, and we just have to make the best guess at what happened.
And what happened was spectacular. I recall reading about auroras being visible in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly, people could read at night by the auroras in Colorado.
Right.
And
yes,
supposedly, telegraph stations had so much induced electricity that some of them burst into flame. Is that correct?
That's right. And they failed. Well, of course, if it burst into flames, I guess you could figure it would fail. But some didn't burst into flame, but some failed, and that's because of the induced currents from the Earth's magnetic field being disrupted, coupling into the telegraph lines. And we have to remember, too, that the auroras also occurred in the southern hemisphere, Aurora Australis. In fact, you know, it was seen in Queensland, Australia, which is pretty far away from the southern auroral oval. It was a huge event, and the flare was, of course, what was seen, but the CME, the coronal mass ejection that accompanied it, sent all kinds of solar material towards the Earth, and that's what really screwed up the Earth's magnetic field and caused all the problems. You know, if we would have had radio back then, there would have been solar radio blackouts, the bands would have gone away, and the Earth's magnetic field would have been disturbed for several days, screwing up the ionosphere after the effect of the solar flare cleared. So it was pretty major. The biggest solar flare in our lifetime was back on April 24th in 1984. It was, again, it exceeded the scale of our instruments, but they think it was greater than X13. So there's been some pretty big solar flares. And of course, one of these days we'll have another one. So, you know, hyping it is, I guess, something that we have to realize, because nowadays, if something like that happens, all our satellites and everything, we're going to really struggle.
I'm glad you brought up the fact that there have been other flares after the Carrington event. I remember the one in 1989 also that brought down Quebec Hydro and their power grid for some time. I've also read that investigators looking at ice cores and tree rings have determined there were massive flares. Well, for example, in the year 773, I believe, somewhere in that area, in the middle of the medieval period, there was a massive flare. So these happen from time to time, correct?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, and the sun is, you know, it's fusing hydrogen and helium. So there's lots of energy released, and things can happen on the sun that release these big flares and the big coronal mass ejections. Undoubtedly, we're going to have another one in the future that's big. We just don't know when. And, you know, the warnings by the media are good in that I hope it makes us think of ways we can harden our equipment or work around those failures.
Now, Carl, do these flares of this magnitude, do they tend to happen at the peaks of the most active cycles? For example, the spectacular cycle 19 in the late 1950s, or can they happen during any cycle?
Yeah, they can happen any time. The Carrington event happened in around the peak of cycle 10. So that's when flares and CMEs are most prevalent, around the peak of a solar cycle, but they can happen any time. I also mentioned Carrington's colleague, Richard Hodson. You know, just like the Yagi antenna, it was really two guys, Yagi and Uda, but unfortunately Uda most of the time gets dropped and it's a Yagi antenna. And similarly, this was a Carrington event, not a Carrington Hodgson event. So sometimes you're in the wrong place at the wrong time and the other guy gets all the credit, but that's the way it goes. I should mention that flares and CMEs are two different mechanisms. We can have a flare without a CME. We can have a CME without a flare. And it just so happened the Carrington event had both from the same area on the sun. And that just tells us there was a lot of energy that was pent up and the magnetic field got tangled and something had to give. And that something was a flare and a CME, which was a pretty fast CME. It reached Earth only in about 17 hours, which normally it takes a couple days for a CME to hit Earth and screw up the Earth's magnetic field and then screw up propagation.
You bring up a good point, Carl, one that I wanted to raise, and that was with the solar observation spacecraft that we presently have in position, how much warning would we get if there was another massive flare?
Yeah, well, flares, the energy, you know, is electromagnetic energy. That's how we see it. And we don't have any warning. What that usually says is there might be a CME following, which does not travel at the speed of light. So we may have a day or two warning that something's coming. So a flare, it happens and it's at Earth already. So we can't do anything about that. But the CME, we can nowadays take a better look at what happened on the sun with coronagraphs, which block out the disk of the sun so we can see if any material has been ejected around the perimeter of that occulting disk.
I know that some utilities have stated that they are making some preparations for this possibility. One in particular talked about a system that could very rapidly take the grid offline before there could be considerable damage. Is that something that would be practical, do you think?
Steve, I'm not real sure, but it sounds like that's something that is good to look at. I guess that's all I can say about that.
In other words, there'd be a brief power outage rather than
right.
Power outage that would last for days.
Yeah, and I'm sure people would complain about the power outage, but once they realize what could have happened, they might be happy that, hey, that the power company did that.
Well, can I put you on the spot? What do you think the odds really are, considering how this solar cycle looks at the moment? Are we talking about significant odds of a major Carrington event type of flare, like the media is saying, or is it more nuanced than that?
At best, it's a wild estimate, but you mentioned the one that happened in, I think it was 753, and it seems that these big solar flares occur about once a millennia, once every 1,000 years. So, 1859, I think we've had, like I mentioned, that 1984 flare. So it may be a while before we see another big one, but don't get lulled into a false sense of security, I guess. I think it could happen any time, and I don't know what to say about the probability.
Well, at least some people, some companies, are taking the threat seriously and starting to make preparations. Even though the media is obviously exploiting the scare factor of this, there is a significant grain of truth behind it.
Yes, there is. Yeah. It's really fascinating to read about all the stuff we're learning about our environment. And things can get interesting, I guess.
As long as we're talking about the solar cycle, how is the solar cycle proceeding so far? Is it panning out to about what you expected?
I'm not sure what I expected. I would hope for a big one, but it doesn't look like that. Right now, we're about halfway from solar minimum to its peak. Probably in the next 6 to 12 months, we'll have enough data to pretty much say, this is what cycle 25 is going to do. Right now, it's doing a little bit better than cycle 24, which was the last cycle. It was the cycle 24 was the smallest in our lifetimes and the fourth smallest in recorded history, which goes back to about 1750. So it doesn't look like it's going to be a really big one like cycle 19, the biggest in recorded history, or cycles 21, 22, which were very good back in 1979 and 1989. So we'll just have to take what we can with FT8 being so dominant nowadays. There are lots of propagation that we weren't even aware of. And all it takes is those digital modes that can decode signals farther down into the noise. And I just saw on Bernie McClenny, W3UR's Daily BX, this morning that Ned, AA7A in Arizona, he's the vice director of the Southwestern Division. He worked Israel on 6 meters, FT8. So I guess it was yesterday. So things are looking up. And of course, you have to be at the radio to take advantage of all that. But regardless of whether cycle 25 is kind of like cycle 24, in other words, a small one, I think we're going to enjoy lots of good propagation. And I would expect to see a great improvement as we move into the fall and winter months here coming up. the higher bands, I think, will provide lots of opportunity for worldwide propagation for those with modest power and modest antennas.
A couple of weeks ago, when the solar flux index went over 150, 10 meters burst wide open for several days. It was spectacular. It was like the good old days on 10 meters.
Yeah, the good old days. Yeah, okay. Okay. And we have to remember, as we move up cycle 25 or any solar cycle, there are going to be spikes in the solar flux and the sunspot number. Around solar minimum, you don't see much of that. It's kind of, things are kind of flat. But as we move up, we've been seeing a lot more spikes in those two parameters. And we just came out of a big spike, and now we're kind of in a lull because yesterday there were no sunspots.
That's right.
But don't worry about that, because that just means we're in a lull, and there'll be another spike in solar flux and sunspot number, and that'll continue to increase the ascent of cycle 25 and bring us really good propagation in the fall and winter.
So we can look forward to exciting times ahead, and I mean exciting in a good way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Especially, you know, technicians who have sideband privileges on 10, they're going to have lots of fun. And I know the ARRL proposal for technician enhancement, once that clears the FCC, that's going to open up some 15 meters to them, higher bands. And techs are going to have a great time, and that's going to certainly swell the number of operators on the higher band.
Well, let's just hope that we don't run into a Carrington event in a couple of years, and everything will be fine.
Everything will be fine, yeah. I've got my old tube radio, so it's okay if anything happens to my solid-state stuff.
Well, thank you very much, Carl. I appreciate it.
Tune in again for the next episode of Eclectic Tech, produced by ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio. Music is provided by Purple Planet at purpleplanet.com. If you have comments, email eclectic@arrl.org. This episode is copyright ARRL, and all rights are reserved. I'm Sabrina Jackson, KC1JMW. See you next time.